and welcome to Money Trail with me, Amir Arafat. Today, the Rockefellers from Standard Oil to Trilateral Commission to today.
The Rockefeller family were part of an elite that grew beginning in the late 19th century and the early 20th century. They were popularly referred to as the robber barons. They moved into the burgeoning industrial structures of the United States, the railroad industry, the oil industry, and later the industrialization as well as banking. They were very ruthless in regard to forcing out competitors. Some of the smaller firms that had initially been in the expansive industrial period were forced out. And of course, their wealth became consolidated and they made a tremendous amount of money.
The Rockefeller family is one of the most important families for the Western white power structure or Western imperialism or Western democratic capitalism, however you want to term it. They've been a family who've been very prominent and powerful amongst particularly the North American, that's the United States of America, ruling elites for well over a century.
Unlike his devout wife, William Avery Rockefeller kept away from the church. He was a traveling man, a salesman who sold quack cures from a wagon out on the western frontier. People whispered about his footloose life. They called him Devil Bill.
Bill Rockefeller admitted to one of his neighbors, "I do business deals with my sons and I always try to cheat them, to make them sharp." Now, John D. did not always like those lessons in business, but he absorbed them.
With Devil Bill, John D. discovered the excitement of taking a big risk, the allure of cold cash. Line upon line, as his earnings grew, his ambition quickened. He borrowed $1,000 from Devil Bill, with interest, and plunged into the risky business of commodity trading, buying and selling meat and grain. He was just 18. Only a year later, the something big he was looking for surfaced in the backwoods of Pennsylvania. Oil. News of the discovery unleashed pandemonium as thousands of speculators descended upon the region. Overnight, wildcatters stripped away whole forests and put up thousands of rickety derricks, hoping to strike black gold. As the oil gushed skyward, fantastic stories appeared of instant fortunes. Among the Cleveland businessmen lured to the region was John D. Rockefeller. He was no wildcatter. He saw that drilling for oil was a very risky business. Refining, not drilling, he decided, was where the steady money was to be made.
The Rockefellers emerged in the late 1800s, and they started out in the oil patch like a whole lot of guys did, wildcatters in Oklahoma, Texas, Louisiana. But what happened was they cut a deal with the railroads, which were controlled by the Morgans, and they got preferential shipping rates on their oil. And then by 1895, John D. Rockefeller had bought out all the small refineries, his competitors. And the way he did that was he cut the price of crude oil to a point where no one else could afford to pump it anymore. And he was even losing money, but he knew that by doing that, he would run these guys out of business. And then he'd have control of that market.
Soon, a new rail line linked Cleveland with the oil region. Rockefeller built his refinery right beside it. It was one of the first in the city to produce kerosene, a new fuel for lamps that was cheap and clean. The poor man's light, as John D. called it, would bring a brilliant glow into American homes. The soaring demand for it, he was convinced, would make him rich. Obsessed with the business of oil, he mastered every detail, developed new products to sell. By age 25, his refinery was one of the largest in the world.
It was at that point that John D. began to conceive of the oil industry as one big interrelated mechanism. And you couldn't just change one component. You had to control the entire machine.
In a move that would transform the American economy, Rockefeller set out to replace a world of independent oil men with a giant company controlled by him.
Well, oil was very important to America. Oil is important to America now, of course. Back then, oil was such a major factor in the U.S. economy. And John D. Rockefeller, the original Rockefeller, he began in a small way. He began buying up his competition. He was a ruthless businessman. He forced smaller competitors out of business. He grew bigger and bigger. There were no trusts. He literally had a monopoly on oil until Teddy Roosevelt came around and busted up big oil.
In 1870, begging bankers for more loans, he formed Standard Oil of Ohio. The next year, he quietly put what he called our plan, his campaign to dominate the volatile oil industry, into devastating effect. Rockefeller knew that the refiner with the lowest transportation cost could bring rivals to their knees. He entered into a secret alliance with the railroads called the South Improvement Company. In exchange for large, regular shipments, Rockefeller and his allies secured transport rates far lower than those of their bewildered competitors.
In order to further expand his big oil empire, John D. soon found himself in need of big money and big banking. That's when the Morgans came in. The story of how the House of Morgan and House of Rockefeller got together to forge one of history's unholiest of alliances.
And the Morgans and the Rockefellers, were both financed by Jacob Schiff, Kuhn Loeb, and back in the 1800s, the big push in the United States was this westward expansion. So what the London bankers really wanted was, to basically tap into the vast resources of the West. And so they financed the Morgans and the railroads, and the Harrimans were involved with this too. Edward Harriman was a very powerful railroad man. The Vanderbilts were involved with this, Cornelius Vanderbilt. But the Morgan Bank financed it.
Yeah, nothing can operate inside the United States, whether it be in industry, in government, or in politics, without the endorsement and the support of the major banking institutions. The Rockefellers, of course, went into banking as well, and they, of course, had both an industrial base. They had tremendous interest in the oil sector, and also in financial institutions. And of course, this gave them a tremendous amount of power, not only in terms of production, but also in regard to politics.
Ida Tarbell, the daughter of an oil man, later remembered how men like her father struggled to make sense of events. An uneasy rumor began running up and down the oil regions, she wrote. Freight rates were going up. Moreover, all members of the South Improvement Company, a company unheard of until now, were exempt. Nobody waited to find out his neighbor's opinion. On every lip, there was but one word, and that was conspiracy.
I think when we're talking about the Rockefeller family, what we're talking about is the monopolization of wealth and power. And I think monopoly and the strategy of monopolization is a central characteristic of the imperialist capitalist system. Without monopoly, you would not have advanced capitalism in the so-called West, because what monopoly does is basically the big fish eat the little fish.
The image that was always used was that of the anaconda, the squeezing python-like grips of this economic snake that was just taking individual entrepreneurs and just putting them out of business and reducing them to kind of economic strait where they had no alternative but to really to sell out to the principals in this conspiracy. It was a conspiracy, really. It was one of the first great economic conspiracies in this country.
In an effort to thwart the scheme, Many independents refused to sell crude oil to Rockefeller and his associates. Undaunted, Rockefeller used the threat of the South Improvement Company to intimidate his rival refiners in Cleveland. His brother and business partner William characterized the plan as war or peace, sell out to Standard Oil or suffer the consequences. Rockefeller might create a shortage of the railroad tank cars that transported oil. He might go out and buy up all the barrels on the market, so a competitor would have no place to store his oil or ship it. He would even buy up all the available chemicals that were necessary to refine oil. Rockefeller instructed Standard Oil men to communicate in code. The company was nicknamed Club. John D. Rockefeller was referred to as Chowder. Many of Rockefeller's targets had no idea that the local refiners who were slashing prices and acting like competitors were actually part of Rockefeller's growing empire. In just 2 months, he had taken over 22 of the 26 Cleveland refineries, revealing the single-minded drive that would make him both the wonder and the terror of American business. Methodically, secretly, John D. Rockefeller was doing more than transforming a single industry. He was changing forever the way America did business. The day of combination is here to stay, he declared. Individualism has gone, never to return.
By 1879, when Rockefeller is 40, he controls 90% of the oil refining in the world. Within a few years, he will control 90% of the marketing of oil and a third of all of the oil wells. So this very young man controls what is not only a national but an international monopoly in a commodity that is about to become the most important strategic commodity in the world economy.
The Supreme Court of the United States dissolved the Standard Oil Trust. Teddy Roosevelt was president. He was a Republican, but he was a trust buster. So he broke up the AT&T monopoly, broke up the Standard Oil monopoly. But what ended up happening was the Standard Oil Trust was broken into about 25 different companies by state. So you had Standard Oil of New York, which later merged with Standard Oil of Kentucky to form Mobil. You had Standard Oil of New Jersey, which merged with some other Standard Oil state companies to form Exxon. Standard Oil of California was Chevron, became Chevron. Standard Oil of Ohio became SoHio and then was bought by British Petroleum. Standard Oil of Indiana was Amoco. So you had all these Standard Oil companies that ended up being state Standard Oil companies. They merged with each other, these 25 companies, eventually became really more powerful than ever because of that, because there was, you know, the Rockefellers, this decision by the Supreme Court was actually an economic boom.
As many of you already know, the Rockefeller family is one of the wealthiest families on the planet, with independent estimates pointing upwards of $11 trillion. The Rockefellers have a proven history of lying in order to conceal their true wealth. They own the majority stake of ExxonMobil, which is the world's largest publicly traded oil company and the world's largest company by revenue. Exxon holds the record for highest profits of any company ever. The Rockefellers also own JP Morgan Chase, which is the largest banking institution in America by deposits and market cap. Chase, in turn, operates the largest hedge fund in America. It was during David Rockefeller's years as chairman of Chase that he devised a plan to build the World Trade Center complex. And with the cooperation of former New York State Governor Nelson Rockefeller, the Rockefeller family commissioned the first designs for the World Trade Center. Along with the World Trade Center, the Rockefellers have been involved in many large real estate projects, such as One Chase Manhattan Plaza, the Council of the Americas, the Museum of Modern Art, Colonial Williamsburg, the Lincoln Center, the Embarcadero in San Francisco, and many more.
And it's not just the oil patch. The Rockefellers, they own, you know, they control Honeywell, they control Monsanto, they control Quaker Oats, they control United Airlines, American Airlines, you know, just on and on and on. You know, AT&T, they control just a vast swath of U.S. industry. and all the insurance companies, New York Life, Equitable, these are all Rockefeller companies. So they vertically and horizontally integrated across the U.S. and global economy to a point that it's really almost like Alice in Wonderland. I mean, people won't believe it until they actually start researching it, and then the facts are just right there. So just go ahead and research it. Everyone should.
The Rockefeller family has also been instrumental in creating and chairing various private and politically motivated institutions.
It was 1973 when the Rockefellers decided they needed their own State Department. The foreign policy was too important to be manipulated from behind the scenes.
Here are the facts. According to their website, the Trilateral Commission was founded in 1973, bringing private sector leaders together to discuss global issues. This organization filled a crucial gap in communication between Europe, North America, and Asia. Originally, the founders envisioned a need for closer cooperation in an era of increasing interdependence as the U.S. lost some of its old influence. Nowadays, the common term for this sort of interdependence is globalization. The group has three chairman positions, one for each region. The Trilateral Commission is a small group with around 390 members.
The reason they call it trilateral is because they were trying to integrate U.S. policy with European policy with Japanese policy. Those three entities, well, North American, I should say, because Canadians were also part of that. So it's this globalist, internationalist attempt, you know, to basically create this new world order, to basically create this situation where national governments would no longer have power.
The Trilateral Commission is attempting to create a one-world government. Other groups, such as the Bilderbergers, have also been accused of pursuing similar goals. Several U.S. politicians, including Barry Goldwater, also believe the Trilateral Commission is an attempt to consolidate power and influence outside of the traditional political structure, ultimately with the goal of overpowering governments.
The formation of the Trilateral Commission in the early 1970s embodied David Rockefeller, and he had a tremendous amount of influence over the Trilateral Commission. It was an effort to create dialogue between wealthy elements within North America, Western Europe, and Japan.
The commission was founded by David Rockefeller. During this time, he was also running the Council on Foreign Relations, another elite international organization. The first trilateral group included carefully screened private citizens. In fact, one of the commission's rules prevents members from holding public office during their membership. This doesn't mean they can never hold public office.
Just to tell you sort of how powerful they are, I mean, Paul Volcker was the Federal Reserve Chairman in this country for many years. And when he retired as Federal Reserve Chairman, he became the chairman of the Trilateral Commission.
After all, Paul Volcker was a trilateral member until he became the chairman of the Federal Reserve. After his term as the chairman was over, Volcker returned to the commission. Jimmy Carter was also involved with the Trilateral Commission, and when he became president, he picked several commission members to serve under his administration. This organization has also held the ear of other presidents. Although Ronald Reagan did not initially approve of the organization, he did eventually come to see the value of the group, inviting trilateral members to the White House in 1984. This revolving door membership makes many politicians uncomfortable, and it's no surprise.
If you look at what's happened since then with, you know, for example, NAFTA, WTO, all these international trade agreements, these international, you know, free trade umbrella groups, this is all an offshoot of the Trilateral Commission.
Moving beyond the Trilateral Commission and Council on Foreign Relations, the Rockefellers are also heavily involved in the Bilderberg Group. The Bilderberg Group encompasses influential players in the fields of business, media, and politics. They meet in secret locations once every 4 years and discuss secret plans. David Rockefeller is the original U.S. founding member of the Bilderberg Group, a life member and member of the Bilderberg Steering Committee. Bilderberg members include David Rockefeller Jr., Jay Rockefeller, Zbigniew Brzezinski, Hillary Clinton, Bill Clinton, Tom Daschle, Chris Dodd, John Edwards, Tony Blair, Bill and Melinda Gates, David Gergen, Chuck Hagel, John Hines, Vernon Jordan, Henry Kissinger, Dan Quayle, George Pataki, Hank Paulson, Colin Powell, Condoleezza Rice, Bill Richardson, Paul Wolfowitz, and many more.
What's in a name? Call them social upper class, call them socialites, jet setters, Illuminati, 13 families, so on and so forth. The Rockefellers and their friends. They say money is the root of all evil. But before being the root of evil, money is the root of power. The power root of more and more money. Let's see how these huge families interact with other players and agents of power equations. Now, the socialites, such as the Rockefellers, also called jet setters or social upper class, Morgans, the Rockefellers. Then we have, of course, the policy planning network and the corporate community, all of them interacting. The policy planning network also includes the politicians in Washington, D.C., in the case of the United States. And we have hired experts, boards of trustees, boards of directors of different corporations, the CEOs, executives. This is the core of this power elite. But the power elite also need talking heads and thinking heads. The thinking is done by the huge think tanks they fund. And of course, the talking is done by their corporate media. So next time you check out a media outlet or a think tank someplace, always follow the money.
America and European countries, and I'm afraid too many others, have the best democracies that money can buy. The powerful interests, the powerful business interests, get whatever they want because they buy the politicians. Sometimes they become politicians, and then they recycle back into business. There is an unholy alliance between business, and big government. It's true in America, it's true in Europe, it's true in many other countries. It really is an unholy alliance. And you combine these forces, one hand feeds the other, and they harm so many people in what they do. That's the way the system works. It certainly is the way America works. Politicians, corrupt politicians, in bed with corrupt CEOs, and they literally steal what they want. They benefit each other. They harm the world. The politicians wage wars so that these ugly people, the corporatists, can make money.
When father of modern political economy Adam Smith wrote his treatise on the nature and causes of the wealth of nations, there's no way he could have imagined only in two centuries the world's top 100 GDPs, 51 places are occupied by corporations. Adam Smith happened to be alive today. Perhaps he would write another treatise, but this time, the causes and nature, the wealth of corporations, big, huge families. From Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations to Francis Fukuyama's End of History, just a span of two centuries or so. But is this really the end of history?
All empires in world history end. America will meet the same fate. When will it happen? I don't know. But going over American history, and I think this is very instructive, there have been different epochs in American history. America was pretty modest. It wasn't much of a developed country before the period following the Civil War. We had the age of the robber barons from 1865 to about 1901. America grew very, very prosperous. The railroads came into being. Large corporations were formed. This took place over that period, about 36 years. The Progressive Age succeeded it. It lasted until the 1920s. The Roaring Twenties followed that period. Roaring capitalism, gross excess. It came apart in 1929. We had the New Deal that succeeded that epoch, and then Harry Truman's Fair Deal, and then Lyndon Johnson's Great Society. And that ended in the mid to late 1970s. And ever since then, we've had the most extreme form of capitalism, gross exploitation of ordinary people. But this has started to weaken in the post 9/11 era. You would never know it, but one of the reasons that America has waged all these wars was to preserve this epoch of capitalist excess. And the more wars that America wages, the weaker America becomes. Its end is out there. I don't know when it'll come, but it will come because America cannot sustain this. It's spending itself into bankruptcy. It's overreaching. Its policies are absolutely beyond the pale. They will simply come to an end of their own accord because they can't continue.
Well, thank you for watching. Always follow the money trail with me, Amir Arfa.